everybody, and welcome to an episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am speaking to registered vet tech and emergency critical care vet tech specialist, Kelly Fultz. We delve into the sensitive yet vital topic of addressing medical errors within the veterinary team. Kelly also shares 5 to 7 practical tips you can begin to implement right away for treating neonatal and pediatric veterinary patients. You don't want to miss this episode. Hi, Kelly. I am so stoked to finally have you on the podcast. How are you?
I am great now that I am here with you.
Ah, I know. We are like kindred spirits, and I'm surprised we've never met in person, but I'm sure we will. But we have met through the beautiful world of VetMed, and social media helped a little bit as well. But I love Kelly. I love what she does. She stands up for veterinary professionals, which we are all out here trying to do. The more of us doing it, the better. So I figured I'd start, since everyone's probably not familiar with your amazing career. Can you just start by introducing yourself to the listeners, briefly sharing your career path? And we all have our niches and passions that we find throughout that path, and how you found yours.
Yeah. Well, we'll begin. My name is Kelly Fultz, and I currently live in Alabama. I am a credentialed veterinary technician since 2006. So we're creeping up on 20 years.
Woo-woo.
I say credentialed because I actively maintain kind of the alphabet soup. Like, I have a certificate in Florida. I am licensed in Georgia, and I'm registered in North Carolina. And then in Alabama, we're also licensed as well. So maintain those credentials. And then I'm also a veterinary technician specialist in emergency and critical care, the oldest and most fabulous academy, in my opinion.
Fair enough.
And the short version of my career is I was supposed to be a college professor of English and creative writing. I was supposed to be a working poet, and I did not come to veterinary medicine until after I got a bachelor's degree in English with honors and started an MFA program in creative writing with a focus in poetry. And I did about a year of grad school and just really hated it. I took like 2 gap years between undergrad and grad school. And during that time, I was very obsessed with the TV show Emergency Vets. Alameda East.
So I remember, sidetrack, but most animal shows on TV, I'll be honest, they're all super triggering because of the
terrifyingly
lack of
bad.
The lack of medicine, the lack of hygiene. Like, but I remember watching that show and I was like, that was a good show on. Yes. Sorry. Random.
That was on Animal Planet. Like, before
was
Animal
actually
Planet.
Good.
Yeah. It was actually,
well,
about animals.
Now it's about animals, like hurting people. And
well, it's about personalities, right? It's not really about animals anymore.
Jeez. But yes, I love that. I haven't thought of that show in forever, and I was obsessed with that show. Sorry, random. Go.
Well, I was obsessed with it too, and this is how old I am. I used to record, they would have holiday marathons like on Labor Day, and I would record them on VHS so I could watch them later.
I love that so much.
And I, when I get done with this, I have like this full circle story that I'll tell you about that show. So I was living in Atlanta during those 2 gap years, and I was working for Borders Bookstore, which RIP Borders. I had worked for Barnes & Noble for like 4 years in college. And I was looking for a second job. And I actually answered an ad in the paper for a CSR at a pretty big multi-specialty 24-hour ER in Cobb County. It used to be called Cobb Emergency Veterinary Clinic. And I started working as a CSR from like 6 p.m. to 4 a.m. And that was amazing. I think when I was a tiny, tiny child, right, I think most of us wanted to be veterinarians, and then other things intrude. Like, I had this long list of stuff I wanted to be. Like, I wanted to be a veterinarian, and I wanted to be a nurse, and I wanted to be a fashion designer, and I wanted to be a Civil War historian. And like, you know, just whatever comes along. And it really took me back to like the animals. Like I'd always had animals and pets and, you know, was a horse crazy kid and crazy about bugs and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And it was amazing. What really turned me on though, was not what the doctors were doing, but what the technicians were doing. And honestly, that's the first time I had ever seen veterinary technicians like on TV. And then when I was at Cobb as a receptionist, because I came from a small town in Northwest Florida and every practice was like a two doctor, their wife ran the office,
right?
You know, high school kids, even if your animal was hella sick, like they sent it home at the end of the night, you know, to stay with you overnight and you would take it back in the morning. So it just blew my mind. And then I got into grad school and I moved to Milledgeville, Georgia, which then was an incredibly small town. There was like a military boarding school and the college and then like a very wealthy like community on a lake, like 45 minutes away. And that was kind of it. And I did the first year of grad school and really hated it a lot. And then in the summer between the first and second year of grad school, I called my parents and I was like, I want to drop out of grad school and go get an associate's degree in veterinary technology. And they're like, please God, let this be the last degree, you know?
So hard to decide what you want to do for the rest of your life when you're 18.
Well, and the pressure is so real, right? Like, you know, there's the whole camp of like, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And then the other camp is like, do what you love and you'll hate it by the end of 5 years. Like, so I had tried to follow my strengths and I really decided I didn't want to go down that path. And so, yeah, I kind of did it all backwards. So I, in my mid to late 20s, moved to Athens, Georgia, where I went to Athens Technical College, had an incredible experience in school. I loved school. It was like the happiest 2 years of my life. Like I was learning stuff that mattered. And I lived in this little house in the middle of nowhere, like on a pine tree farm. And I had too many animals and I wasn't dating. And it was amazing. It was like all I did was like animal stuff and school stuff. And so then I graduated in 2006 and became registered in Georgia. That was my first credential. And then worked in what we would probably think of as like a shareholder owned kind of urgent care, like lots of treaty, you know, like we weren't doing sustained critical care. Like those kind of patch them up, send them back to the reg vet that was a shareholder, like in the morning when the clinic closed. So I did that for about a year and really wanted to flex. Like I had gone into school knowing, I think because of Alameda East and being at Cobb, that I wanted to go back into ECC. Like GP never tempted me. I think a lot of people come to emergency and critical care from GP because they do that for a while and they start to feel restless. And I was completely inverted. So I started working at UGA in the ICU in 2007. And that was very eye-opening. I had never been exposed to that degree of like morbidity and mortality. I mean, it's tertiary referral, right? It's academic tertiary referral. So you figure most of those cases have seen their reg vet or an ER. You know, they may have seen a secondary specialist and then
overall more challenging.
Yeah. And so that was a lot. I really struggled in that environment. And I actually had a boss who pulled me aside and was like, I think it's time for us to consider that critical care is not for you. You might want to go back to GP.
Yeah.
And I am insanely stubborn. My grandmother always called it bullheaded cussedness.
Okay.
And I was like, you're not telling me what I'm going to be good at, you know? And so really dug my heels in. And I, you know, made improvement. It was really hard though. I was on overnights.
Yeah.
Which that's when I discovered that's not the life for me. It was kind of a difficult time to be an RVT in Georgia because they were closing their loophole that allowed people to take the VT&E based on job experience.
Right.
And so there were a lot of on the job trained people at the university at that time that were very suspicious and bitter of people with, you know, the degree and the credential.
Right.
So it was a challenging time, but then I was in a relationship and I moved to Pensacola, Florida, and worked in an independently owned specialty hospital. Like, it was owned by one guy who's a DAC vec, and we did ER at night and on weekends. And during the day, like, there was a surgeon and there was an ophthalmologist that would visit like once a month from Tallahassee. So we got to say we were a multi-specialty center, but that's where I accrued the cases and skills for my BTS.
Love it.
And then I was there for about 4 years and I just felt kind of maxed out. I wanted to go back to academia. And so I did a crazy thing and I applied for a job at Auburn University, got the job, and then proceeded to commute for two years.
Jeez.
I wanted that job really badly. Like,
no, I understand.
I knew where I wanted to be. And it's like, I was still in the relationship. And so we had this whole routine. I rented a little like 1,000 square foot house in the Auburn area. And I would like get in the 4Runner on Thursday afternoon with my three dogs. And I would drive up about like 3.5 hours. It's about 275 miles. I would work Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I would drive home on Monday morning.
Dedication.
And I did that. Yeah, I did that for 2 years. And I was also teaching at the tech school in Pensacola at the same time. But eventually, my partner, boyfriend, whatever, and I separated in 2014. And so I was able to move to Alabama full time. And then I was at Auburn till 2020. And then I relocated to Gainesville and was at UF for about 20 months. And then I joined Blue Pearl in May of 2022.
Oh, so recently.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting. Yeah. And what I know you have a lot of things that you do at Blue Pearl, but what does that look like?
The closest thing I could probably say.
You're like, how do I describe this?
Yeah. And I feel like we have colleagues that are going to like, when I say this, but
this is a safe place.
The closest thing is kind of like a chief nursing officer, but for the region. Okay. So we have five regions in the company. The title is regional nursing partner. It used to be regional training partner, but the role kind of underwent an expansion in January, like right before I joined the company in May of 2022. And it's now much more focused on everything technician related. So everything technician related for my region comes kind of across my desk. So what that basically means in a nutshell is everything kind of about engagement and career pathing for our assistants and technicians, supporting BTS candidates, medical quality. So having a pretty large role in medical quality initiatives, patient safety event reporting. We have a really robust patient safety reporting system, and we really aim for all of our hospitals to be on a just culture model, understanding that medical errors are generally systems errors. Like, there is a human element, but we're very much into what we call the plan, do, study, act cycle, right? So, okay, we have this kind of medical error. It's nobody's fault. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, I'm going to go to work and kill a bunch of patients today.
Right.
Right. So we try to make sure each of our hospitals has a patient safety / medical quality committee where they can review their reported errors and make changes as needed. So heavily involved in that. Other things for me with that role, certainly partnering with the regional vice president of medicine, which is who I report to. So each one of us has an RVPM that we report to for whatever he needs me to do. So that might be like educating our veterinarians, you know, visiting meetings and calls to talk to them about legality, delegation, optimization of workflow and efficiency, how to bring their people into the circle, right? And make sure that they're engaged. We also do a lot with our internal leveling system. Blue Pearl has kind of I feel like it's fairly unique skills tracking platform. And basically everyone is assigned a job family level when they're hired, and they can continue to advance at their own pace through the leveling system. Historically, it's been biannual, but we're undergoing some changes and it's going to be annual starting next year. So all of that content and process, kind of part of it lives with other infrastructure systems within the business unit, but like the content lives with the regional nursing partners.
Right.
So
you stay busy.
I do, and I love it. It's, you know, it's the perfect job for me because I want to lead. I'm insanely obsessed with like medicine and medical quality and, you know, practicing a high standard of care, but I don't want to make schedules or right. do performance management or do payroll. And so this job is great because I report to the regional vice president of medicine, who's like, I have the most incredible boss in the world. Like, he's ridiculously good at like motivating me and making me feel valued. I jokingly say that it's taken almost 17 years in this industry for me to have a job where I feel psychologically safe.
And I'm so happy that you have found a place, but I also love that you shared that because I think thankfully there are, we were just talking about it before we started the recording. There are challenges, but there are a lot of positive things yeah. that we're seeing in vet med. And whether you call them unicorn clinics or essentially where you feel utilized, valued, psychologically safe, those things are being talked about. And I have to, especially as a behavior person, we focus on the small wins, which are actually big wins. And I think so many veterinary professionals, veterinarians, assistants, technicians have worked at places where they feel stuck and they essentially have some learned helplessness where they're like, it's fucking like this everywhere. So why fucking bother? It's learned helplessness, but we are creating that culture. We are improving and it never hurts to interview at other places. And again, your position is not something everyone would want to do in any context, but you found you have all the skill set and you found something that fits your skill set that you really thoroughly enjoy. I as well have in some contexts, I've created my own positions, but it's worked out for me because it's needed and I have the skill set to do it. So I say this on the podcast all the time, but please don't feel stuck where you're at. It doesn't need to be that way. You are valuable. You matter. And yes, find your niche, all these things that we talk about all the time. But I'm so happy that you found a place that, and also it's perfect for you.
Well, I love it. Like it's, you know, and I haven't even talked about some of the other stuff like visiting hospitals,
right.
and
building,
you know, like mentoring our nursing leaders and representing the company. And I'll be perfectly candid. And, you know, everybody in Blue Pearl kind of knows this, but, you know, when initially I was approached about the opening by, I was jokingly called them my fairy godmothers, but I had a couple of colleagues from Auburn that were with the company and they were like, this is opening up. Like it's open now, this would be perfect for you. And I initially was adamantly opposed.
Due to like, the fact
I can't leave clinical medicine.
Ah, like, got you.
You know, I'm a floor nurse. I'm a creature of the vet schools, like serial monogamous, right? Like I've been at three of the country's like 29 vet schools. Like, you know, I'm a creature of academia. Like I couldn't imagine an identity for myself.
Yeah.
Off the floor. And there was, I think, a lot of that suspicion that academia has for corporate, right? You're like, oh, it's the evil empire. You know, the medical quality may not be there. You know, they're going to tell people what to do and how to practice. And so my friends just kind of kept coming around. Like, come on, like, it's be amazing for you. And I had just kind of gotten to a point where I couldn't see an identity for myself outside of clinical work. But at the same time, BTS of 10 years, like when you kind of get to the point where you can handle multiple like tree of life patients with equanimity, you know, where else are you going to go?
Yeah.
You know, like you have become more competent as a teacher, right? Of vet students and technician students, you are very reasonably good at like running the room, right? Like doing the air traffic control of like stuff is always incoming, stuff is always going out to get imaged or cut or whatever, coming back in various states of disrepair. So I had begun to kind of feel that tickle of like, am I going to do this forever? Like I'm, you know, I'm 45. Am I going to be rolling around on the floor with unhappy large breed dogs?
Yeah.
Like how much longer? And so I decided to just kind of lean into that tickle. And I was like, well, if my friends are there and recommend this, like, you know, and the women I'm talking about are amazing clinicians, strong personalities, you know, ethical, like strong sense of right and wrong.
Right.
And so I felt much more comfortable that if they were well pleased, I would probably be well pleased.
And I think having that mentorship, I mean, mentorship is so important, and having that support to make those scary jumps, which some of the scary jumps I made, I'm thankful that I was in the positions I was in, because I think it's made me so much better for lots of reasons. But also, looking back, I'm upset that it took me so much mental and physical anguish, just a lot of things, because I was afraid I wouldn't be a tech. No one told me this, but I was afraid I wouldn't be a tech if I didn't work in a fast-paced GP. And I am a vet tech, and I do. Now I know how silly that was, but I think so many of us struggle with that, because even the options of talking about all the amazing things veterinary assistants, CSRs, veterinary technicians, veterinarians can do, I think we all limit ourselves somewhat. Even when I go to conferences, it's getting better, but you don't hear about all these other amazing things that we can do at even conferences. So many of us aren't aware of that or exposed to that. And then we're all also, there's burnout and all those things affecting that. So I'm so happy that you found your place and that you got a little nudge from your friends, maybe a few nudges. Yeah. We all need a nudge, y'all, sometimes. And it worked out, because, and now you're a wonderful teacher and you get to help make SOPs. And I love that you have SOPs essentially in your hospital setting, where if there is something that happens, because we're all human, there errors happen, that we look at that data and debrief to talk about it, because that's so important, but also see how we can prevent it and be better in the future. It's the same thing after when someone gets bit. Yes, there's the OSHA stuff, which, don't get me started about OSHA. If anyone wants you to get bit, it's OSHA. Their handling is ridiculous. Anyways, but I actually have forms that I create for vet practices where it's one page and we break down what happened. So, but that's not a common thing. And I'm like, that's mind blowing to me.
Well, and it was so impressive to me, because that's the thing that had always bothered me, right? Yeah. Like, we're in these environments where the animals are very ill and you have a lot of different skill levels.
Yes.
And education levels, right? Like, if you think about a vet school, right? We have pre-vet student workers. We have first year through like fourth year vet students, right? Which is frequently a night and day difference. We have assistants. We have salty old sailor technicians, right? We have new grad technicians. We have house officers. Like, we have interns. They've been a doctor for literally 2 months. You know, they graduate in May and then they start an internship in July. And then you have like third year residents that are basically specialists. And it's always been crazy to me that like stuff happens and then like, where does it go?
Yeah.
You know, like there's an error and an injury, or heaven forbid a death. And then like, you know, who decides how we change course after this?
Yeah.
And I think there's always an element of like, everyone knows, but there's so much shame, right? Like, everyone knows who killed X patient with KCL or whatever.
Right.
There's a lot of like back padding, right? That it wasn't me, but like, they were for the grace of God. Okay. Like, it can happen to any one of us. And that's,
and I think creating that culture is so crucial. Like, I always, me and Kelly were also talking about how we jokingly say things, but it is a joke because that's how we use to cope with things.
I think what's really important to me is, these were the challenges I wanted, right? Like, I felt I had gotten to a point clinically where I knew what to do and what to expect and how to handle like most situations. Like, are there things that I would still love further development on? Absolutely. You know, ventilator waveforms, like ultrasound, all that kind of stuff. But what I really wanted was to move into and lean into the challenges of what it's really like to experience this profession and how to make it better. Because I did have 17 years of sometimes challenging workplaces, right? Without psychological safety, you know, all of the bullying and hazing and unsympathetic manager, you know, stuff that you hear about and we talk about, you know, is very true. People without leadership training or development, right? They're the last man standing. And so they get the job. And I really wanted to lean into that
experience, because you were on the floor, you saw these challenging things. And again, we all make mistakes. And in many cases, there's so much research in human medicine about this, where we're afraid to ask a question, question a doctor. I'm talking about human medicine, and the wrong legs are amputated and severe things because we've created a culture where I can't ask a question and that this environment isn't conducive to learning and collaboration and working together. And also there's so much guilt and shame. Either way, we're going to beat ourselves up, even though we should be kind to ourselves. But I'm going to be honest, we've all made mistakes, and I know we go through it on our own. So we don't need others to remind us or take us down. And that's where I think, I love that you mentioned that, because I think that debriefing, talking about it, addressing it, how we can prevent it in the future. Because I can remember a time, it was very long time ago, where someone gave the wrong injection and they were afraid. Thankfully, the animal, it didn't result in a death, but it was pretty terrifying. And they were afraid to say that they gave the wrong injection. And the sooner we know you gave the wrong injection, the more that we can obviously help. Well, so
I have two stories about this from my own life. And I don't want to take up all of our time.
Oh, no. But I think that I think this is important things to talk about, because vet med is hard. We have to deal with lots of challenging things. And I think from your experience, you're really good at handling those challenges. And not everyone wants to be in that position. So.
So one time, cat ward, fairly small, right? You know, even if we have one, it's usually too small. Compared to how big we'd want it to be, right, as cat people. So, for a cat ward in today's age, decent size, this cat was coming back from anesthesia. And, the whole anesthesia squad is here with the cat. You know, it's on the gurney. We've got like an anesthesia technician and an anesthesiologist and a surgery vet student and an anesthesia vet student. And then I'm in the room. So you have to imagine, right, like all these people crammed in this room. And the surgery folks always set their TEVA for mic per kg per minute.
Right.
And in the unit, we set it on mic per kg per hour. So the settings on the Medfusion pump had to be changed. And so this cat's on remifentanil, and I'm quite tall. I know you've never met me, but I'm like 5'10". And so we're transitioning the cat into the cage. I set the pump up on the top of the cage. I'm like leaning over the anesthesia gurney, trying to change the settings. I couldn't see what I was doing. And the cat got a bolus of remifentanil. And, he got like 10 mils over like as a bolus. And I didn't realize I had done it. Like right. There are all these people, right, shuffling around. And the pump gives that very distinctive beep, like when it's almost empty. And my brain was like, why is that almost empty? And right about the time I was like, why is that almost empty? The cat sat bolt upright, its pupils blew out, and it like fell over like a tree. And at that point, right, like I have no pride. I have no shame. I was like, shit, shit, shit. Like,
yeah.
He just got all that Remy as a bolus. Like we pulled him out. He got two doses of naloxone. He was fine. But like, what if I was too afraid?
Yeah.
To say what happened? What if I was too afraid of being judged? What if I tried to cover it up? My other story. about like a near miss.
Yeah.
I was in the ICU and we had those little brown bags to cover light sensitive medications.
Right.
And the bag was labeled furosemide. I have this heart failure patient. I pull the syringe out. It's got that yellowish tinge, right, that furosemide does. I give it the medication. Then I realized that the syringe is acepromazine, but it was in a furosemide bag. My fault for not double checking labels, right? I had to call the cardiologist who was in an interventional procedure in the cath lab. They put me on speaker. So I had to tell the whole story, right? Because he's scrubbed in, like he can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had to tell the whole story. The whole ER heard me. The whole OR heard me, right? Like the resident, the cardiologist, all the anesthesia people. And then the cardiology resident had to scrub out and come downstairs to check on the patient. And I have never been so ashamed in my life. Like if I could have just melted into the floor, I would have. But that's like, you have to believe that you can say what you need to say and not be frightened.
I really appreciate you sharing those stories, because I'm sure they still bother you to this day, because
shrivel up on the inside.
We've all woke up. I mean, I can't begin to tell you. Thankfully, it's less, and it's probably because I have healthy coping mechanisms, therapy, lots of other things. But also, I mean, we've all woke up in the middle of the night and been like, fuck, Like,
I didn't put dextrose in that bag. And
yeah, even not like an immediate thing, right? Like those, the stories you shared, but it might be, I forgot to double check. I mean, the amount of times I woke up and was like, I forgot to lock the lock. I never forgot to do that. I don't know why I would wake up so much and at 3 a.m. and be like, shit, I forgot to lock the lockbox with the controlled drugs. It's so challenging, I think. So as far as, because especially you've been in these situations, you've worked in these hospitals, like you mentioned, with in colleges where there's so many different people going in and out, which is challenging on its own accord. How have you, what have you found to be the most beneficial as a manager, teacher, but also as a colleague? To create cultures that are conducive to asking questions, to admitting when you messed up or mix something up.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing, the overarching thing is like, no one wakes up and says, how can I hurt a patient today?
Right.
Right. And it's super important from the start, I think, with your teams, to say it can happen to any one of us. Like, none of us is beyond reproach, and we are not going to judge, right? There are systems factors that sometimes make these things inevitable, right? Like, think about two medications that both start with A, you know, one is like very powerful. One is fairly benign. They're on a shelf next to each other in the pharmacy, right? Sound alikes, look alikes, right? Things like that. You know, a drug for a dog and a drug for a cat, they both have like purple writing and an animal with pointy ears, you know, on the packaging. So there are so many systems factors that predispose us to medical errors that I think it's really important that people understand that part of it. And we can always improve the system, right? So I think candor and trust and everybody understanding, right? The grace is for everyone. And we're not going to play these games of throwing shade, right? Like, I don't know why they hired her. She's so stupid. Of course she killed that cat, you know, with insulin or whatever. So when you hear that, or you see that, or you hear that's happening, like, you have to, like, zero tolerance.
As I 100% agree with that.
Because it becomes way more corrosive on every level, like not just on like a medical quality patient safety level, but like just team dynamics. So yeah, I think making sure everyone understands what just culture really is and understanding there's no such thing as a stupid question. I think building in the resources is super important, right? So do we have a quick reference for drugs? Does everybody understand how to use a formulary? Do we all feel empowered to push back? And that's a huge one, I think. You and I were chatting before we started recording about kind of all the different personalities in this business. And, you know, some of us are perfectly comfortable pushing back, right? And saying, that's not normally how I give this drug. But others are much more like, you know, the doctor's up here. and they decide, and folks are sometimes a lot more uncomfortable with questioning. I think you don't have to be stroppy about it, right?
Like, oh, of course. There's professional.
You can come from a place of curiosity. And I may have learned that in the vet schools, right? Because people come from everywhere. You know, like, yeah, we're at Auburn or UF, but someone came from Illinois or they came from the UK. So it becomes very natural to be like, oh, how do they do that where you were trained, you know?
Yeah, just asking those kinds of questions, even for new hires, I think that's a very simple thing that you can easily implement to create a psychologically safe environment. What is your experience with using this drug? And that's something, interestingly enough, as someone that helps with severe fear aggressive patients, and I'm comfortable with a lot of drugs that understandably general practitioners may not be as comfortable with, because they aren't utilizing them a lot. And as I've gotten more advanced in my career, and I'll be honest, 15 years ago, I would have been like, what the fudge? In my head, I'm not saying it's right, because it's not. But now I ask, what is your, like, that's something I used to never ask. And I consult with lots of veterinarians and professionals in my, like, I'll work with 100 different vets. I think
you're
vets.
In this kind of interesting sweet spot, right, where you know a lot about something that maybe veterinarians don't get that much training on.
Oh, I see.
So it's what you're saying. This yeah. very interesting place you're in where you are not a veterinarian, but you're like advising and guiding veterinarians, which yes. I think is very unique.
I've had challenges as many of us have, but it's also been really eye-opening me asking, what's your experience with this drug? And they may say, or what's your experience? Because I also do advanced handling, which we aren't taught anything about, which I say all the time as any veterinary professional. And I'll say, like, I recently worked with this amazing veterinarian who had never done a walk and poke for a really fear aggressive animal. So we practiced with a stuffed dog, and then we practiced with one of the technician's dogs, and it was beautiful and amazing. And I set that vet up to succeed. I didn't just say, this is the best way to do it, go, which is absolutely, I hope I would never do that, but it's just, I think just that one, I just had to point out that question because I think that's something we can all literally start doing today, whether you are a CSR, a veterinary assistant, wherever you are as a team member, and work to make a difference too. And you can identify where your staff needs more education, because let's be honest, everyone just assumes that your staff knows. I say it with pain scores and FAS scores all the time. I love them. I think they should be utilized at every practice, but you can't just as a manager print out an FAS score and say, go. We have to work on helping educate everyone about body language, more advanced body language understanding, how to implement these scores, which I'm sure you see a lot, not at your field, but
have to contextualize it though. Like when I'm lecturing on feline grimace score, right. I always like to do that. I always like to do a bunch of sample cats, like, in real time in the lecture, because people always have questions. And it's like, sometimes I have a question and I'll say, like, you know, this one is hard to score. Like, here's what he's doing with his body. Like, I don't have any context, you know, I don't know what he's had done or how he was acting yesterday, but, like, you know, here's what the tool gives us. Right. And then we have to build our competency with it. I think the other thing that you brought up that I think is also super important is, it really gets us in the mindset of asking like an open-ended question. Like if you say to someone, have you ever done this before? Right. That's yes or no. Have you done a walk and poke? Yes or no. It doesn't leave any room for, and it went horribly, and I still have nightmares about it. So if you say, what's your experience with a walk and poke? It creates a space, right, for someone to say, I did that once and it was awful, and I swore I would never do it again. And now you're telling me this is the only way to do this, you know, like to accomplish what we need to accomplish with this patient. And I'm really uneasy about it. So much better than yes or no.
Yeah. Cause I think automatically, right? How many times we all know that when we're talking to caregivers or colleagues, we can say the words, but your body language means something else. And so many times people are like, did you understand that? And they say yes, just out of like embarrassment or.
I've done it.
I have definitely done it.
You know, like.
I've definitely done it. So I think, yeah, communication style. I've learned so much about communication, thankfully, because of behavior. But I think just the way, the language that we choose to use, the words that we choose to use, the way we choose to present it is so powerful. Like you said, if we're asking about a drug, like, why are you using this drug? That's very different than asking it. And that veterinarian or technician may become reactive based on
that. Or you can be like, wow, it's been a minute since I used this. What's your favorite thing about using this drug for this?
Exactly. We need to create some scripts. I love scripts. I do that a lot. Okay. Mental note. We're going to make a resource for talking points.
I love scripts too. They're so great in the ER, right? When you have new people and you're super flustered, right? The first time you're confronted with like a screaming, crying owner.
Oh, yeah.
And you're trying to get information or like a CPR decision out of them. Like everything you think you know about communication goes out the window.
Because you're dealing with a human who's over threshold, which is a whole nother.
Well, it's the worst day of their life. They don't know you.
Yeah.
Like they don't know anything about science. You know, they've just seen a bunch of medical TV shows where everybody survives CPR.
Oh.
But that's a whole other.
Yeah, that's a whole nother. I'm sure we all, I mean, we all see human medicine shows, and I'm sure we're as triggered as human doctors and nurses when we see, but it is TV. It's just also, I think, like something I say about behavior all the time, I think it's really important to be aware of what the general public is being sold, the cultural fog, because we can then use that information. It's kind of like CBD products, right? Obviously, I'm not a huge proponent. There are benefits to pay. Check out the episode. Not behavior, in my opinion, but I'm very aware of cannabinoids and how they're used and what's being sold, because that's what caregivers are being marketed. So I think we can't just ignore it and be like, meh. We have to know about even the things that might cause us confusion or frustration, which is partially why a lot of us love this field, but also I can understand why sometimes it's frustrating.
For sure. For sure.
So I know we started, this was not our plan to talk about this, but I think it's such an important topic. So asking open-ended questions, not judging, starting the conversation with, this could have happened to any of us. I think, again, such a simple thing that is so powerful. And then, of course, Blue Pearl, you have, it's definitely based on what you've shared, you have really strong SOPs and you're always improving and changing those based on things. But for a practice that may not have those resources, let's say something happens and they utilize some of the things you already mentioned, as far as debriefing, looking at the data of what happened and improving, where would you recommend that general practitioner to start in those contexts?
There's a lot of good stuff out there about debriefing. So I think any kind of general search on debriefing in a medical setting will probably yield you some good results. There may even be some really good stuff linked like through Recover and like CPR debriefing. We emphasize that heavily within this specialty, right? Like every code ideally should be debriefed. I think it's really important with debriefing to kind of read the room. Like, so let's say, you know, the ER is really hot. There's some sort of issue, right? Do we want to debrief there in the moment when people are distracted and stressed about being further put behind on their work? Or do we want to kind of do it at the end of the shift, right? If people are very emotional, right, there may definitely be a case for letting everybody kind of calm down. And I think the thing with debriefing is it's really important to make space for feelings, but they can't be the whole thing, right? You don't want to wind up in a situation where two people are shouting at each other,
right,
about, you know, you always, you never, you know, I told you not to X and you did it anyway. So there is a little bit of finesse to it. I think structuring them is really good. So, you know, what went well, what is an opportunity for improvement, you know, try to stay away from what went badly or what did we do wrong. You know, thinking about the way we debrief on CPR, it's very much like, you know, where did we shine? Where could we improve next time? And then kind of go around the circle on like, what's one thing that you individually would do differently, want to try differently next time.
I think that's wonderful. And then also you're enabling and empowering critical thinking. And they're, again, very simple thing. Love all these tips. They're great. To start to create that psychologically safe culture. But also in the moment, you're given more, essentially, they're getting more critical thinking skills and they're getting more skills to think about in cases like that. We all have learned from every case that we have done. And I think talking about it, and then also you're, of course, building up the team. Oh, you're
well, and everyone can participate, right? Especially right. Like debriefing after a code. And, you know, just like to be cheeky, right? Some stuff is easy, right? If you've ever tried to like do a code with only, you know, two available ET tubes, right? And they're both the wrong size. Or if you've ever like not had a laryngoscope with a light that worked on the blade, like, right. You know, that's low hanging fruit, right? Like someone's going to be real cheeky and be like, well, make sure all the equipment works, you know, next time or whatever. But it gets really interesting because you can say like, did anyone notice X, Y, Z? You know, did anyone notice the way that thus and so stepped up and started scribing, you know, even though she works at the front desk and she was just passing through, but like,
And then highlighting each other also, because I think sometimes we all get caught up and the team dynamic is a big problem at a lot of practices, and it's not always the person. I understand
tense
cases.
Situations get tense, right?
Yeah.
Like, we definitely, like, I know, for example, personally, like, it's not that I get barky, but it's like, I'm going to be a very direct communicator in a tense situation, you know, and it's going to be like, you want that closed loop communication X and you do Y. And then Y says, X says, you know, I have done Y. Like, you've got to close the loop. It really is team building, I think, to debrief.
Yeah.
Because think about the alternative, right? Like, we go through this code or whatever, you know, like an animal strangling itself, like in the cage, like, you know, on a fluid line or something. We go through this and then we all just break and go back to our day. And people are wondering, like, how'd that happen? What happens next? How do we keep it from happening again? Like,
yeah, narratives are created and then people start disliking each other based on false.
Well, yeah,
concepts.
Like, she wasn't paying attention.
Yep.
Like,
exactly.
She wouldn't switch him to an
anti-tangle.
It's
so dangerous. It happened
like,
so quickly.
Dr. X didn't even care. Like, he just walked away. Like, did anyone talk to the client? Like, there's so much that can go wrong if we don't, like, kind of structure it and like, lay it back out.
And I think that's also really helpful because let's say something like that happens during the debrief. Because I know I worked at mostly general GPs, but we had emergencies frequently and we had a really good team dynamic and we had the person that was leading. And then, for example, I would commonly, because communication and loving humans and animals has been one of my skill sets. So I would go talk to client, but it was very clear versus because we all want to help. And we've all seen like the memes and the jokes. Funny, of course, humor is helpful in times of stress. But where 30 people run to the dog and the 20 people standing there are actually causing more problems and issues. So having structure and practicing ahead of time and then knowing as a team member what I should be doing, talking about that before a code even comes in, that is so powerful. And again, a very simple thing that every practice can do.
Well, and I love drills.
Yes.
Like, I worked with a criticalist who... would sneak the CPR dummy out of the unit like in the morning, and then he would like hide it in a closet, and then at some point during the day he would come barreling down the hallway with it, like screaming,
yeah,
you know, at the top of his lungs, and like fling it on the wet table. And you know, and initially, right, students are like, are you effing with me right now? Like, or, you know, like they're very self-conscious, and then like you have to run it like a code. So I love drills. Because the more often you do them, the more of a smoothly oiled machine you get.
And the more confident
like,
and prepared.
Right, people are dropping stuff and like running into each other.
Because there's such high intense situations, and the more skilled you are. It's kind of like handling. I teach handling, and I do not start with live animals. If you don't even understand where to put your elbows, and that would be me failing.
Having a live patient is not going to help.
A teacher. And then we'll start with, once you have that skill set and the foundations, then we'll start with relaxed patients. Then we'll start. It's the same thing with a fire drill. I was going to say in human
medicine.
Well, and
the other parallel I draw is like with pediatrics and neonates, right? It is super high investment, super high emotion, right? Like we all want the little one to do well, you know, and the breeder may want it to do well because, you know, they need that income, or the animal's already promised to someone, right? Someone's already bonded. Goodness knows they've put the time and the labor in, right, with the litter. And then we want it to work out because, like, they're small, they're helpless. Like, we don't want them to suffer. We don't want them to feel pain. So it can be really emotional, just like CPR.
Oh, for all of us. And what a wonderful segue. I'm definitely going to have Kelly back on to talk about all the things, but we love a quick tip. So, and obviously these tips may be longer than 30 seconds because nothing is that short. I do not expect that. But what are, based on neonates and pediatric care, because again, it's similar to behavior where in veterinary medicine, there aren't as many resources available for those things, although they're things we deal with frequently. And you love neonates and pediatric care. And we all know, right? Cats aren't just small dogs, and neonates are not just tiny cats or tiny dogs. So what would be 5 tips for treating overall, right? You probably have hundreds of tips with all your experience, but 5 tips for treating neonatal and pediatric veterinary patients. Ooh, y'all, she's stretching. She's ready.
Yeah. Okay. One, you kind of already said it, right? They're not tiny adults. So I would encourage everyone to read up on the truly fascinating physiologic differences between neonates and adults. The first one that comes to mind is their difference in total body water. Your neonatal animal is probably about 80% total body water versus an adult, which is about 60%. So that it's like a perfect storm. They have a high energy and water demand, but they have insanely immature kidneys. And so they are at once predisposed to overhydration and dehydration. Right. So that's the fine line that we have to walk. So that's the first one is just check all of that out. It's insane to me, right? Like, their neurons aren't fully myelinated for weeks after they're born. You know, their liver's immature until they're several months old. Like, it's crazy. They're like little aliens. The second one I would say is if you're trying to warm them to adult body temperature in the first couple weeks of their life, you're making them too warm. Like, they tend to run a little bit cooler. And that is super important because people are like, well, I wanted him to be like 100.5. And I'm like, oh, he only needs to be kind of like 97-ish, 98-ish. I'm really gratified that most people seem to be more aware that you really should not feed them if they're cold. So there's a little bit of bickering back and forth about what that magic temperature is. I usually say don't feed them if they're under 95. Some people will say 94, but when they are cold like that, they're very prone to ileus. And whatever you feed them is just going to sit there and kind of predispose them to regurgitation and potentially aspiration pneumonia. I've lost count. Was that? That was 3.
You did 2. You did. You did 3. You were correct.
Okay. So the next one is going to be don't overlook the significant importance of the umbilicus. That's one of our number one routes for neonatal sepsis. And so you should always be checking if they still have an umbilicus, they're probably less than 3 days old, like piece of it attached. But you always want to check that area for swelling, redness, kind of blotchy mottling, discoloration, moisture. So even when they get a little bigger, like always check kind of their belly button. And then super easy, like TJ Maxx for the win, tip number 5. Just grab yourself a bunch of blender bottles. Like, you can get like 1/2 liter ones and liter ones. I love a blender bottle for mixing formula. It's been life-changing for me. Anyone who's ever tried to mix KMR with a tongue depressor.
Oh yeah.
In a break room, it's like lumpy and just blender bottle.
Amazing tips. And you probably have tons, but if we all need to know more, I mean, there's certain things where I joke, like in Ohio, you need vitamin D. You need to take additional vitamin D. And we all, as animal professionals, whether it's animal welfare or vet med, need to know more about neonates and pediatric care. Where are a few of your favorite resources to learn more? Do you have a few favorite textbooks or websites?
You know, there's a few textbooks out there. I think they're all a little bit older at this point. I am a big Google Scholar person. And so honestly, what I like to do is just go on Google Scholar and like search for canine neonate or feline neonate. There's a couple of good studies. I wish I had come better prepared. The Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery just put out a really great, like, big fat PDF about care of neonatal kittens from birth to weaning.
I will get it from Kelly because I want to read it as well. And then we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that has come out. I love the Facebook group. And of course, the name of it escapes me now.
But we'll get it.
Yeah, it's basically Ellen's group.
Oh, Ellen. Yeah, Ellen Croza, the cat LVT. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. She has a wonderful Facebook group where, you know, it's really lively. People post pictures. People post questions. it's very much a community of like-minded individuals.
Love it. So amazing.
I recommend that.
So thank you so much for all your amazing tips. So many like golden nuggets that you have shared with the listeners today. Something I always like to end with is, what is something that currently brings you joy? But also, because this is one thing that brings you joy, because you're doing this amazing, I know that VECCS has created a task force and there is a survey right now. So I want one of those things to be the things that bring you happy, and just let the listeners know what that is. And I will definitely share links in the show notes. Please take a minute to fill it out as a credentialed technician. We really need your help. And so does Kelly.
Yes. So about the survey, Bex put together a task force. That's the Emergency and Critical Care Society. We're really excited about this. It's a fairly large group. And one of the things that we wanted to do was explore some of the challenges, but also the opportunities for credentialed veterinary technicians, not just in the United States, but potentially worldwide. So we have this chunky, beefy, fairly detailed survey. Like, it's, you know, it's not like a 3-question survey. All right. So you're going to have to commit, you know, probably about 10 or 15 minutes to it. The link was emailed to all VEX members, and it is also making the rounds on social media. I believe that NAFTA has shared it on their Facebook page.
Awesome.
We are working our way through, you know, a big long list of state tech associations trying to get it out, but probably the NAFTA Facebook page is going to be the easiest place to find it until we link it through the podcast here. But yeah, it's just going to ask you all kinds of questions. We wanted to add to the body of peer-reviewed literature about veterinary technicians in an impactful way. So that body of literature is sparse but growing,
right,
is what I would say, right? Like, we've seen some really good studies. Like, obviously, NAFTA has the demographic survey. David Liss, I know, has done some really good peer-reviewed work on, like, salaries, right, VTS versus otherwise. There's been a couple of good studies about extrinsic and intrinsic motivating and demotivating factors for veterinary technicians. I'm working with Nathan Peterson at Cornell and a couple of other folks to produce a paper on the effect of futile care, so medical futility.
That's exciting.
On credentialed veterinary technicians. So hopefully the survey that we did last fall will come out as a paper eventually. So yeah, please participate in this one. I think we all love to give our opinion. I always joke, like, I'm a super opinionated person. Like, everyone's entitled to my opinion, like, even people who didn't ask for. So think about it as like a Yelp review of like your experience as a technician, and just unload, right? Like give us the tea. We need
it. And this is how we can get better. They need your feedback. Again, your feedback matters. You matter. And you have an opportunity to share your feedback. So
yeah. And I know there's some survey fatigue, like, in our profession, right? Like,
yeah,
you get a survey every time you get Chinese takeout, you get a survey when you buy a sofa, like, our lives are full of surveys, but I really want to encourage you to participate in this one. And also, as a preview, we'll also be conducting one for veterinary technician specialists pretty early in the new year as part of the same task force. So I'm really excited about that one too, because there are a lot of questions on that one that I don't think anyone has ever asked.
I'm excited to fill it out.
Yeah. And then one, there are so many things that make me happy right now.
I know,
but
I love that.
One thing that makes me happy right now is, we did not get a chance to talk about this, but I started horseback riding, English riding lessons when I was 28.
Oh, look at you.
Because I was horse crazy as a child, but had no outlet.
Yeah.
And so I started riding when I was in tech school, and I have not been in a regular lesson program since like 2014. Like, I was in lessons regularly when I lived in Pensacola, but even though I have my own horse, we have not been in lessons for almost 10 years. And I recently started lessons again, and I am riding a large pony. Like, that's just like what it sounds like. He's technically a pony, but he's like the biggest size pony you can be and still be considered a pony. So you have to imagine like 5'10", 46-year-old me on Panera. That's his name, because everybody loves bread.
I love that so much.
Panera the Large Pony. And so we have a standing date every Sunday, and that just makes me thrilled.
And Kelly will send me a photo after this recording.
I'll send you a picture of Panera. I don't have any of me on Panera. I'm not brave enough.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, thank you for everything you do, for your patience. Thank you for everything you do for everyone in this field. We definitely need more people like you, Kelly. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the podcast today.
I'm so glad you invited me. This is so much fun. I could, you know, it's always, I told Jeff Backus and Dave Cowan at that tech cafe that I always wanted to be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And so whenever I do a podcast, I'm like, this is as close as I'm going to get to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And Dave was like, who's Terry Gross?
I used to be fair. I used to listen to with some changes in the political field, climate. I took a break from NPR, but NPR was my go-to like driving in between music and podcasts. And I probably should start. So I used to listen to Fresh Air. I know exactly what you're talking about. There's something about their voice. It's just really relaxing.
Yeah. Just like the faintest lisp.
Yeah. It's just really relaxing and interesting. Again, lots of different viewpoints and like, and she's a really good interviewer. But anyways, maybe one day let's get Kelly on Terry Gross.
I think I have to write a book or something first, right? Like, or we have to make a movie or something.
Who knows what we'll be doing in 5 years. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, there should be a vet tech movie. How is there not one?
I mean, I'm still waiting for a really good TV show about it. Like, it makes me really sad whenever
I hear you.
Whenever they try to make a good show, like, weren't they shooting one right at like Penn at the vet school that lasted like a year? And then Nat Geo was like, no. But then Dr. Fred Ozark vet with his armpit hair sticking out of his tank top in the surgery suite, like, he's still on TV.
So. The struggle is real. I actually talked to Nat Geo once about, that's another story, about possibly doing a cat behavior show. It obviously didn't happen. They were really nice, but I was in the early stages where I wasn't communicating with Nat Geo as much. But also, of course, I'm going to talk about it, try to do the opportunity, go send them the bee footage and all that stuff of me. But also in the back of my head, I'm like, you claim to be a science-based channel that have Caesar Milan and things that have literally ruined people's lives and mine a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's, but again, then we want to be out there creating actual evidence-based fun, because you could be evidence-based and super fun. Me and Kelly are those people. Mental note, future, I think we definitely need to do a vet tech documentary. A few of us can get interviews. Now I'm getting ideas. It's bad when I'm with Kelly. I've had like 30 ideas that I need to do now.
I'm here for it.
Oh my God. I'm going to write this down afterwards.
Glad you invited me. What a wonderful way to spend a Sunday afternoon.
Thank you.
Catch you later.
The plan was not to discuss addressing medical errors, but Kelly started to speak about what she does at her job, and I was like, this is so important. We need to delve more into this, and I'm so glad that the conversation went there. So I hope you enjoyed. How do you debrief at your hospital or shelter? Do you not debrief at all? Let us know. Email via social media, and have an amazing day, everybody.